Check. Okay, we'll get started. I see that everyone's got grabbed their boxes there. Just in case, the restrooms are all the way at the end if you want to use them later on. With that, I guess you can get started, David.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. And for our online audience, for our online audience, continue the banter with the hashtag, and the streams are all up and running right now, so shouldn't have any problems. Sorry, David. It's all yours.
Good afternoon. My job for the next hour is to keep you awake, right? Because then by 2 o'clock, you'll all be having a sugar low and needing to go and get some, I don't know, sodas or something like that. My name's David Egan. I'm going to start off a little bit slow just as people are filtering into the room, and then we'll pick up the pace a little bit, hopefully. I've been working with Windows Azure for, since January 2008, when it had a real cool name of Red Dog. Led the evangelism team that built a lot of the early content, worked with a lot of the early adopters, people that you might have seen on a stage at PDC and all that kind of thing. So my talk is all about building applications for the cloud. And I kind of sat down and I thought, well, what do I want to cover here? And I figured, you know, if I 2 years ago said, you know, what's the things I would want to know about building for the cloud, this talk captures some of that. So there's some topics in here that you're going to find hopefully really useful. There's going to be some concepts that will be new to you. I've been monitoring the tweets, and there's a couple of tweets that I think I saw that we didn't quite answer in perhaps the first few sessions. And the first one was, can I just take an ASP.NET app and run it in Windows Azure? The answer is yes, asterisk. The asterisk is, well, it really depends upon what your ASP.NET app does. If it's just ASP.NET, you're not doing anything fancy, you're not in the registry, you don't have any huge footprint in the OS, you're just using a SQL database, likely, yes. Now, that's all I'm going to say on that, because we have a whole talk on migrating applications afterwards. But I just thought I wanted to kind of nail that point, because it's relevant. I really want to focus on building some new things for the cloud. Yes, we can take an app and we can migrate it, and there's some great things we can do there. But what about building new apps for the cloud? What's the cloud good at? So I thought I'd start off by just kind of going over a couple of the patterns that we're seeing from our early customers in the TAP programs and other early adoption. What kind of the patterns we're seeing here? So the first one is a kind of on and off workload pattern. Now, one thing I want you to keep in mind is that you've got a cloud. You've got theoretically unlimited resources in the cloud. You're just going to pay for it when you need it. So there's this concept of, you know, well, one, my app's only used between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., said one early adopter. Can I just turn everything off at 7:05 and bring it back on at 6:55? The answer is absolutely yes. So during the day, you can be running with 20 servers, 20 instances running, and then on a night, just turn it all off. You might want to leave one running. I don't know. Depends on how confident you are. You can spin your workload back up. But that's one option. What about the option of like, hey, I want to do this job, and if I put 1,000 servers on it, it's going to get finished in pretty quick. Can I do that in the cloud? Absolutely. On, off. We were toying with giving out accounts and things online. So you'd hit a web page on a Friday morning at 9 a.m., and the first 500 people would get like a free trial or something like that. If we built that app Friday morning, guess how many servers we need? More than one, hopefully. The rest of the week, probably not that many. In fact, we could probably turn it off for a lot of that time and be fine. Growing fast. A lot of startups love the cloud. In fact, if you're a startup, your VC's probably told you, you've got to use the cloud. If we can scale out, if we build our application so we can scale out, when we get more users, when we get more people using our application, buying our application, we can just turn the dial up, bring on more servers, bring on more databases. And it's a consumption-based model, right? So I don't have to go out and buy my huge, big server that's going to handle what I think might be my peak load. As a little exercise, I priced out one of those big, whopping, great, big servers from HP last night. And it was one of those fairy tale buys where I didn't actually put my credit card details in. But I managed to spend $144,000 on a single server. It was a 48-way box. It had 512 gig of RAM, 15,500 RPM drives. Great, and it would have really kicked ass on some workloads, right? But what if I needed to then go to 49 cores? I've then got to think about, how do I bring my other machine on? When you're thinking about the cloud, I want you to think about lots of little things that you can bring online. And scaling out was certainly one of the messages we tried to land throughout this morning. Lots of little machines instead of one big crazy-ass machine. That allows you to scale and grow fast. Some of our early adopters were building Facebook apps. Facebook app is a magical pattern, right? Week one, you have 200 users. Week two, you have 2,000 users. Week three, you have 2.5 million users. Week four, you have 20 million users. That's if you've got a good Facebook app. Building that kind of app on a cloud is ideal if you get it right. Because then you just crank the dial up, sit back, drink your whiskey, whatever takes your fancy. We talked to some customers who didn't do that and hit the 20 million mark and basically spent 3 weeks solid rewriting their app as they went along. And they did things like dropped all the indexes from SQL, got rid of all the triggers, got rid of all the stored procedures. Like, they gutted the thing. And a lot of what you've heard in Brad's talk about this kind of table storage might seem a bit weird. But when you're talking about billions of rows, it's not a bad thing to look at. When you're talking about scaling out past what one physical machine can do, it's really important that you get lots of little things, lots of little tables, lots of little partitions within a table. And then you can just keep on growing and growing and growing. And let us worry about how many servers we need for your partitions. You don't pay any difference. It's 15 cents a gig no matter which way you do it. Unpredictable bursting. Like some people say, hey, I got slash dotted and my traffic went, ooh. We often get phone calls on a Monday saying, hey, my site's going to be featured on Opera on Wednesday. We need to move this to Azure because we've been told to expect a workload of about 20 million users. Well, yeah, great thing for the cloud. Lots of the times we can help. Lots of the times we just don't answer the phone. But great, if you build and take into account the idea of scaling out again, when you do get on Opera and you do get the 20 maybe 200 million is more like it for Opera, is you can handle that. You can turn the dial up and kind of handle that workload. And then there's the kind of predictable bursting. Predictable bursting just feels like one of those funny words, but what we mean by that is seasonal variance. It could be weekly. I run all of the reports on a Friday. Let's have more reporting things going on a Friday. I do month end every month. Let's have more things running at the month end. If we're in the vacation business, used to be that January and February had the most vacation packages are booked during those 2 months of the year. Hundreds of servers may be needed. Rest of the year, a couple will probably do us. So think about those kind of usage patterns. And also, none of these have an average line through it. But if you think about any of those patterns where you're on and you're off and you're on and you're off, your on could be way greater because you're not paying for the off time. So if you can afford to run 10 instances for your app, but you only have to do it 12 hours a day, then does that mean you can run 20 instances, get more throughput, more performance, and so on? So start thinking about these little ideas. I remember Chris Auld talked at Mix on the storage talk, and he said they use 51 gig databases for SQL Azure to handle ticketing workload. So the customers ticket direct, sell tickets for events. So U2 goes on sale at 9 a.m. They'll bring on a whole bunch of servers, but also a whole bunch of databases so they can get the throughput that they need for that. So, you know, think about those things. So I wanted to kind of, I thought about the development process. I thought about building applications, and I thought, what do you guys need to know that's not in Brad's talk or David's talk or you know, Mox will touch on some things, but, you know, let's dig a little bit deeper. I wanted to start off with the development environment. Now, hopefully you all understand a line of code in here, right? I'm hoping most of us do, kind of thing. I would ask for a show of hands, but I'd get disappointed if only two people put them up. So, yes, we've got the SDKs. We've got the Windows Azure SDK. You can download it. It gives you that cloud on a box, so you can develop and debug locally. You don't need a cloud to get going. SQL Azure, remember, David Robinson said it's just SQL, so why not start using just SQL locally? Start your dev work there. We also have the App Fabric, which is the service bus, which enabled you to change Mox's desktop. It has an SDK as well. Download that. It doesn't have a local component yet, so you're going to have to use the cloud for that piece. So you, at that point, you will need an account. I'm going to get onto accounts in a moment. Also, Visual Studio is a great tool for building these cloud apps. Whether it's 2010, 2008, we like to think we have the best tooling. There's also Eclipse tooling. There's also command line tools in the SDK. If you use Visual Studio Express, the SDK works fine. You can build and publish and all that kind of thing. If you're not a Visual Studio user, download the SDK and use all the command line tools to do that. That's how we package up PHP apps or Java apps. We use the command line tools rather than Visual Studio to do that. Now, that's kind of the things you think about. No, I get started. Well, great. But what's about the other stuff that they don't tell you? So here's a couple of things that we don't tell you. First of all, how the hell do I get started with table storage? Go and download the training kit. It's a shameless plug because my team builds it, but go and download it. There's some hands-on labs in there that walk you through all of the getting started about the whole platform, whether it's the service bus or compute or deployment or whatever like that. The next thing we find that is really incredibly useful is we have some PowerShell commandlets that automate management tasks in the cloud. So building an app's easy. We can all write some code. But deploying it to the cloud, you've got to go to the portal. You've got to do a whole bunch of tasks. We've got these PowerShell commands which automate that. So you can literally deploy an app with three key presses. I'm going to show you that in a moment. You will need a subscription. We have a whole bunch of terminology around accounts and billing and subscriptions and all that kind of crazy stuff. So I'm going to walk through how that fits together, what the terminology is, because if you're starting off a new dev team, you can run into a whole bunch of problems if I sign in as David Aiken and I create the project in my live ID. Guess how many devs have to share my live ID now? All of them. So we want to kind of talk through that a little bit. A certificate. It's not like I've used the cloud and you get a little certificate and it's got a little badge on or something like that. In order to automate deployments and let your dev team work against the same deployment, you can put a certificate in the cloud, which then allows you to use the management API. I'm going to show you how that works as well. And then you probably want some storage tools. Now, on the SQL Azure side, it's easy. You use the SQL Server tools or two tools to connect to the cloud, and then it's just create table and all that kind of funky stuff. Against Windows Azure storage, out of the box, we give you a nice, shiny client library, which is essentially an API. So if you want to view what's in your tables, you write some code, right? Because we love the cloud. No? Okay. So there's a whole bunch of tools available now that you can get to plug into your storage, let you query across your tables, let you view what's in blob storage. And you've got to get one. Like, as soon as you start using storage, you're like, did it work? Is it in there? And in SQL, you would just run a quick select query, right? We all know how to get the results back. In Windows Azure, we want to probably use some tools. So I'm going to show you some of the storage tools as well. Equally, diagnostics. When your app's on your box under your desk or in your data center, you can walk up to the box and plug in and have a look at what's going on in the app. You can look in all the logs. You can look at the perf counters. You can delete files and do whatever you like. In the cloud, you can't get in there. Right? You give us your app, we run it, that's it. You want a remote desktop into it? Sorry, not today. So how do you do this diagnostics thing? So I'm going to work on, I'm going to show you a little bit later on how we can set up all of this diagnostics and some things to watch out for. And I'm on this machine. So billing and subscription. Oh, we need a credit card to sign up. Okay. When you go on and you're setting up a brand new billing account, you will need to enter into our system and put in some sort of payment method, usually a credit card. Once you've done that, you create a subscription. Now, the billing account is one live ID. The subscription can be the same live ID or a different live ID. So here's the thing. I'm the finance person. I will create the billing account. Steve Marks wants to build some apps. I will create a subscription using Steve Marks' live ID. Now, he can log on. He can use the service, but he won't ever see a bill. I get the bill because I'm the billing guy. He can't get at my payment details either, because then he'd just go and order a load of crap, right? So I own that. And I can create as many subscriptions within my credit limit as I jolly well like. I always talk about it the wrong way at bills. I don't know why. So I can create multiple subscriptions. So one idea is, hey, I'm the project manager. I'll create a billing subscription. And then each of the devs on my team, I'll create a subscription for, and they can all log on and deploy their own apps, but they can't see each other. So if I give you a subscription and Steve a subscription, you can't see each other's apps. So normally our devs work in a team. How do we get them all onto the same page? Well, over here we have a certificate. We'll create a certificate and install it into the Windows Azure portal, and then we can use the API. So if I do this on a subscription and I give you all the certificate, you can then use the API and the commandlets to deploy apps all into the same slot. And that's how you probably want your devs teams to work. Okay? So demystifying that a little bit. Now, I did promise a quick demo at this point. This is my demo machine. I've got a bunch of demos. I'm not as brave as Steve. I'm not going to type any live code and try and run it. However, I do have a dependency on the cloud, so long as the internet connection stays going, we should be good. So this is my account. I have an app. I have a project already created. And this is one of the apps we're going to talk about. So if it doesn't actually deploy, this talk ends in 4 minutes. Only funner. So this is PowerShell. And I'm going to use three fingers, right? Three key presses to you. I'm going to press D. I'm going to press Tab. Dave, that's autocomplete. Yes, I know. It's great, this, isn't it? And I'm going to hit Enter. So that's three key presses. Now, yes, I've tweaked everything, and I've wrote a script to do this. But look, I've wrote a script, and now I'm babbling on over this side of the room. And meanwhile, what it's doing is it's taking my package, my project output, it's uploading that to Blob Storage. And then once that's finished, it's going to tell the management, the fabric, and the cloud to go and deploy this app. And we should get a couple of little messages back as it does this. Now, without touching the keyboard, we can flip this down a little bit. In fact, if we move it over here, it's much easier when you've got a bigger screen, I guess. But and you can use a mouse is another thing. So what you should see in a few like a minute or so, is that status on the web page will change, and it'll start deploying the application. It's crossed. So that's great. I can automate deployment. If you're following some of the work patterns and practices are doing, they actually now have MS build tasks, which take kind of the same code that we have in that script and make it as part of your build process. And if you just go one step further and have your source code in TFS and you have a build server and you want to do daily builds and deploy to the cloud, working. It's working. You want to do daily builds and automatically deploy to the cloud, perhaps in a test environment, because here's another thing. When you're testing apps in the cloud, you can use the real cloud. You don't have to build the entire data center on a single VM in your office. You can go, hey, I'll just use the real cloud, and there it is. Ooh. And the great thing is that on and off scenario, I can deploy to the cloud, I can run all my tests, and I can undeploy, and I can automate that using these PowerShell scripts, using the API. Cool, yeah. I can also mess the script up and leave something deployed for a few weeks and not realize it and have a big bill. So you'd be careful. So how do we do this script? Well, there's two scripts that I actually wrote to set this up. See, I can't even type. And let's have a look at the first one here. So the first one is called setup.ps1. And basically, it adds the cmdlets into PowerShell. And then I just set a couple of things. One is I set a cert. So I have a cert on my machine, and I go and find that. And I go and save that as cert equals get item, blah, 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 blah. Somebody remember that the cert thumbnail begins with 444. The next thing we've got to remember is the subscription ID. That begins with C. That'll be enough to remember, won't it? So that's 555 and B or something. Service is ARC2. That's the name of the service. And then I've got the path to my package and the path to my configuration. So when I'm deploying to the cloud, I only need these two files. Whether I'm using the SDK or Visual Studio, publishing will create those two files for me, and then I'll be able to upload them to the cloud through the portal or through the cmdlets. So where did I get this information from? Well, if I go into my account, and look, it's initializing now. It's, you know, hands-free kind of thing. I'm going to click on account. And the first thing is my subscription ID is down the bottom. It begins with C, so that's kind of right. So I cut and pasted that from there. The next thing I did is I went in to manage my API certificates. And here's the certificate begins with 444. And this is the one I put all my dev boxes. I just export this with the private key, go and install it on all my dev boxes, and away I go. To upload new certs, it's just simple. You upload the CRE file. To build it, I go into the IIS management console. This is on my blog and a whole bunch of other places. And essentially create a self-signed cert and then export that. That's how I create it. So completely, you know, you don't have to go and buy a couple of $100 cert or anything like that. You just go and create your own on that. And that's all I did to get that first piece. So then the next piece of the script, the one that I actually ran, was called deploy. And this has a couple of, in fact, I do it this way. When we zoom in, it will be a little bit easier. And then I've got a couple of commands. One is get hosted service. So I go and find the service with the subscription ID, with the certificate, and that gives me a service object. That's representing on my machine the service running in the cloud. And then I go and pass it into a new deployment. I say the slot is production, and then I pass in the package name and the configuration and a label so I can give it a version number, if you like, where I'm going to store the blob. And then once I've done, I get the operation status and wait for it to complete. So I just sit at the end of that PowerShell statement and wait until that has done. And then the next line, the set service to running, basically gets the same service, passes it in to get deployment for the production slots, and then sets the deployment to running, and again waits until that's complete. So it's fairly easy to compose up these commands. I could have typed them individually, but it's real easy. If you go to the blog of Mr. Ryan Dunn, who built these cmdlets, he has some examples that you can just lift straight from there. And literally, this is all I did for this. I just changed that sub ID and the thumbprint, the package paths, and everything else just works hunky-dory fine. And we should see this app's still kind of going through its deployment phase. We should see it running in a couple of minutes time. We're going to flip back to the deck and walk through it. We do use this app a little bit later on, so if it doesn't work, I'll sing and dance or something.
Can I ask one question?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you need to publish your application? You run the PowerShell script, or is there a way to have the PowerShell script do that?
So the question is, do I need to publish my app before I run the PowerShell cmdlets? I'm not quite sure what you oh, yes. So, yes, because you need to generate the package.
Okay.
Yes.
There's no way to
you can absolutely automate that as well. Yeah. What's the latest cloud cover show? Is that Friday's just gone?
Yeah, it's just this past weekend.
So they do a show on Channel 9 called Cloud Cover Show, and it has a walkthrough of kind of the MS Build tasks and things like that, so you can automate that. I'm usually in Visual Studio. I hit build, publish, and then just hit the script and then go and make a cup of tea or do something else or whatever. Cup of tea is the English thing.
Retire a subscription because like 10 developers are there, 3 left the company or something.
Yeah,
then they have the subscription ID, which is used for them. And what is the easiest way to change? So, still applications are existing.
So I think the question is, can you delete a subscription? If I summarize it a little bit, or is it? Can I remove the deployments from a subscription? Let me answer both of those questions. So one, real simple, delete the subscription, call the help desk, tell them you want to delete the subscription, and they will do it for you. You don't even have to write a script for that, because you can't. Okay, moving on. You can write the script that enumerates every service that you have running and then undeploys them all. So if you're conscious that your devs are leaving stuff running overnight and they don't really need to, and you've put your cert in to their subscription, you can just have something that runs every night when everybody, and just deletes all of the subscriptions out. So you can automate that deployment, undeployment. I say delete the subscription, I mean undeploy the application. So you can do that and automate that. And we pay for usage the same as you do. It's inside Microsoft, it's cross-charged and things like that. But we're conscious of running up our bill for demos and things like that. So we invariably run scripts that kill off all the subscriptions and deployments and accounts and things. Got to remember that when you're trying to show somebody in a bar or something like that, your demo, and you've shut it off. Anyway. All right, so that's billing the subscription. The API, get familiar with it. Spend a little bit of time getting some scripts worked out for yourself. You're going to save hours and hours of clicking around the portal and things like that. So the app we deployed is actually a good example of a new cloud-like app. And I'm going to show you the Archivist. We talked a little bit about this at MEX, but I'm going to show you kind of what we've done with it. Now, this isn't my project. A guy called Carsten, who works in DPE, is building this app. I'm merely the cloud advisor on this thing. So I've been helping out with the architecture and things like that. But essentially, the app allows you to create an archive of Twitter feeds. So if you're really interested in, for example, bacon, and would like to know all the tweets on bacon, you can come here, type in the word bacon, and what happens is we save that in a database. And then every 30 minutes or so, we go to Twitter and we say, give us all the feeds with the word bacon in. Then what we do is, because that's really useful, right? So then what we do is we analyze those tweets and we tell you who's the top tweeters, what's the top keywords in those tweets, and so on. So let's just have a look at, not bacon, because that would be fun, our tweet for this event, the Windows Azure Firestarter tweet. Now, because it's an archive, we don't believe that we need to do this update in real time. So we've got a couple of decoupled processes that do this, and I'm going to walk through those in a moment. But essentially, this was last run at 8:24 p.m., which, we also invented a time machine. Because this runs in about 7 hours' time. It's running UTC time in the data center. Now, that's another gotcha. In the Steve knows, because I pinged him last night going, why is my date thing not working? He went, UTC time. So when you're doing date comparisons and things like that against storage and whatever like that, UTC time is the way to go for this. We've left it there. It's probably filed as a bug already, because it really should show your localized time there, but hell, it's still in development. By the way, if you hit this, you won't be able to access it. Because it's password protected. I have to check with Carsten. I can give this out. If I can, I will tweet it on that tag a little bit later on today so you can get in and have a play with it. We make no guarantees this will run for very long. But I've stopped them from doing deployments today because this isn't something we built as a demo for this. This is a real app we're building. So it's pretty neat. But as you can see on this, the top people talking about it are the organizers. Workflow guy out there. Bondi Geek. These are the last posts we actually got, which is great. There's a delay. Because now if you're all tweeting something about the current presenter being a whatever, it's not going to show up on screen, so you can stop trying. Also, what's the top keywords? Retweets versus tweets. We're doing pretty good there. Awesome. So how many tweets was there? We've collected 270 tweets. I suspect there's a whole bunch of them in the queue, but because of the way they've got it running today, there's a huge gap between everything to give us some time to have a look at all the stuff that's being collected in between. So it's running a bit slow. But there's 270 tweets there. Now, if this was a fire starter about Lady Gaga, we'd have 6,338 tweets. So, again, pretty kind of neat. And you can do comparisons and things like that. So that's the app. It's a cloud app. Why is it a cloud app? Well, it's running in the cloud. But it meets some of those requirements we said earlier. We've got a case where we will grow. We've got cases where we might have big spikes. We get /dotted or something like that, and everybody starts archiving all their pet names and things. We're going to get these spikes and bursts and things like that. So we're going to need to know how many people we've got using it at any one time, how many archives we're building, how often it takes, how long it takes, how many instances we should be running, what do we do in case of failure. So this is one of the two apps I'm going to use to kind of talk through some of these points here. So the app's very simple. We have a table with all the search terms in. And then we have a little query that goes, hey, give me all the search terms that we haven't updated in the last 30 minutes. Woohoo. The version in the cloud has that table in SQL Azure. Why? Because it's real easy to write a where clause on the date time column in SQL Azure. In Windows Azure Table Storage, we'd have to design our partition scheme to make that easier. And it just made sense to do SQL Azure. Then we go and query Twitter through the API. So we go and make a call to Twitter. We get all the feeds back from that. We use a third-party library to go and do that. So we get back a stream of data. We actually convert this to JSON and store it in blob storage. Why do we convert to JSON? Well, we've got this idea that we can just serve that straight into the client. So if we built a nice Silverlight client or Ajax client, we could just go and bring the JSON straight back. There'd be no processing. We'd pull it from the CDN. And that seems pretty cool. We'll see how well that works when we actually go and build it, but that's the current thinking. We also then have to aggregate the results. So we've got all the tweets, and then something goes and takes a pass through them all, calculates the top 10 users, the top 10 tweets, the top URLs, and all that kind of thing. So what we've done is, that's our three pieces. And they can all be done individually. They can all be chunked up and done separately. This is the key. We do this about 200,000 times an hour. This is what we're currently thinking around where we'd like to see the app in a couple of months' time when people can start really using it. We think we'll be doing about 200,000 of these an hour. So I don't know if anybody's real good at maths and can tell me how many seconds is in an hour. I used to be able to do that, but yeah. So how many of those do we have to do a second to get some sort of linear performance? And what's the bet that we won't have anywhere near a linear thing? Be more spiky and so what did we do? Well, we decoupled everything. What we didn't want to do is have the task like this. We read in the search query, we go and make the query, we bring the results back, we do all the aggregation. Because at any point in time, we might fail. I have a great slide later on that talks about fail. But at any point in time, we might run out of steam, our data, hardware might crash, whatever like that. It's a guarantee we're probably going to fail at some point. You've already seen, with queues and things like that, we have no transactions. You read a message from the queue. If you don't delete it, it'll appear back on the queue. If you're not quick enough to delete it, it'll appear back on the queue. We make a guarantee that you'll read a message at least once, And I mean at least once. Quite often you read it twice. So Brad mentioned about being idempotent, which means, can I do the same thing over and over again and not change the output of the system? That's another thing to try and get your head around. So what we did is we decoupled everything. So finds search term, reads the query, gets all of the search terms we have to go for, and then puts them all in a queue, one at a time. So it reads in, for mine, it'll read in Lady Gaga, put Lady Gaga in a queue. Read in Bacon, put Bacon in the queue. Read in WFS, put that in a queue. So now we've got all of these little work items in a queue. What happens then is the query Twitter piece reads the messages from a queue. And when it gets a message, it goes and does the work, gets the results back and stores it as a blob. And then what does it do? Puts a message in a queue. It's done with its bit of the task. Aggregate results, reads a message from the queue, does the aggregation, and then we're done. What's great is you can see how we might scale this thing out. The thing that defines the search term, probably one instance is going to handle my workload. The thing that does the Twitter search might want two or three of those things. The thing that does the aggregation, depending on how badly or goodly we write code, we might need 10 of those, we might need three of those. But now we've got the choice of being able to scale up our system independently of the other pieces. How do we monitor the throughput? How do we know how fast this thing's going? Do we need more instances? Does anybody monitor any apps on server now? Server 2008, server 2, whatever. One of the, you know, CPU, memory, disk, blah, blah, blah. And I always remember if there was a Q in the name, if a Q was greater than 2, you were in poo. That was the little rhyme I learned, right? Same idea. You can monitor your queue length. How many messages are sitting in the queue? Oh, I've got 1,000 messages sitting in the queue. I probably want to increase the number of instances somewhere to try and get through the throughput. It's a very quick and very eye on the world of, how well is my app behaving? I don't need to necessarily get into CPU and memory usage, although I might do if I think, you know, with my 10 users, I've got 1,000 messages in the queue, it might suggest something stuck or broken. But I can use the queues to figure out my capacity. But also, it's great, it's decoupled. I can turn stuff off willy-nilly at any point in time, and I'll only use a little bit of work. In fact, technically, I won't lose anything, because if my... Once it's in the queue, so long as I don't delete it, it'll stay in the queue. Even if I read it and then I crash, the message will eventually pop back in the queue so something else can then read it and then crash potentially and be stuck in a kind of loop there. Of course, if I want to scale out, the thing I've got to do is if I have more instances, you know, Brad alluded, we've got a threshold today of about 500 requests per second into storage. I might want to think if I increase the number of instances running, I might want to increase the number of queues and do some sort of, and it doesn't have to be like mad scientist stuff, just a simple round robin of the queues probably going to help. Another idea is every instance creates its own queue. Huh? Well, how's that going to work? Well, it's quite simply, all your queues have a prefix. So my find search term, it puts it into a queue with a prefix of TQ for Twitter query, and then puts a GUID on the end of it. My query Twitter just gets a list of all the queues that start with QT or TQ, whichever one it was, and then just loops through them. So I can build some very simple, basic logic to go and scale out queues very, very easily. The other technique Brad mentioned was bunching up those messages into blocks. I could put 20 search terms into one message and do it in chunks of 20. I've got to figure out a balance between that and how much I want to redo, how much work I have to redo if I fail. Also, I would encourage thinking into storage. The more instances I have, the more queues I have, the more partitions I want to have as well, whether that's SQL Azure or Windows Azure Table Storage. We use blob storage for this. Turns out, because of the different aggregations we do, it's faster just to read the whole darn thing into memory, do it in memory, and then write out the results. We've denormalized this so much we don't even need a table. So what do? We read in a master file, And then we go and calculate what the top 10 users are, and we write the answer to that question out in a file. So when the UI goes and we click on a tag in the UI and it brings back those top 10 users, the top 10 URLs, it's not doing a query. It's just reading a blob in. And the query's already worked out. It's a pre-canned answer. We get away with this because it's an archiving tool. It's not a real-time Twitter thing, right? If we're about 30 minutes out, we think that's probably good enough for the type of usage we see for this application. So we've got a little bit of time there. It's really good. And we have each keyword has its own container in blob storage. So if we have 100,000 keywords, we'll have 100,000 containers. Guess how we move, guess what the partitioning scheme is for blobs? It's the container. So we can move containers around the data center. If it was table storage, we'd need a partition key in there. We'd probably use the keyword as the partition key then. I'm always excited to find out what the build is, and I've just gone backwards. All these instances. Yeah, go on. So the question is, if I see a million messages in the queue, my rule could be, and I could write some code for this, because I can write some code that queries how many messages are in the queue. I can then have a little rule that goes, if messages are greater than a million, go and run this script. And this script might be, go and add two instances. Go and find out how many instances are running now and add two instances to it. And I can do that just at the raw level quite easily. And yeah, it'll take a few minutes or 10 minutes or so to spin all those extra instances. But I could automate that. And even better, I could have that piece of automation code in the cloud itself. So then it becomes almost a self-monitoring kind of thing. We've got a couple of internal tools that do this kind of monitoring. And we're putting together some guidance and things on how you can do that as well. But all the APIs is there, so you just got to figure out what your rule is and what you're going to monitor and measure on that. So all these instances. So right now, today, we've got a good 20 users of Archivist. Do we really need to be running on 5 instances? Probably not. So how do we build some software where the jobs I want to do, and if you're really into patterns and things like that, think about the command pattern. I would say a loose implementation of the command pattern, to be sure. But think about that. So I've got all these pieces of work that can be done. Why do I need a separate instance for them all? Could they just be threads? If I'm testing and I'm paying the bill for testing and I'm just mugging around in the cloud, I might not want 5 instances running for all my different pieces of the worker. I might just want one instance that just runs the code so I can prove all the pieces are working. I'll still have the queues. Feels kind of odd because my single instance is going to put a message out to a queue and then read it back in again. But it'll be a different thread. But I can build my app, I can test it, and not have to go and deploy to hundreds of things. If you decouple from your worker logic, from your role logic, what you actually want to do, the same way as you decouple from your UI what you actually want to do, you can pull this off quite easily. With a few code changes, you can then be running on instances rather than threads. Okay? And I've got an example of where we've done this, and I'll get to that in a wee bit. I don't want to jump around too much in the thing there. So this is kind of an architecture. And why this is an architecture is it's not the architecture that I've just shown you, nor is it the architecture of the version I deployed to the cloud in a different account. This is the architecture when Carson and I chatted the other day, and I drew a diagram after that kind of meeting. But we're using SQL Azure for the search terms. Basically, we've got this work scheduler that essentially every 30 minutes pulls up things. We've got this idea of having to do some cleanup jobs as well, so we're going to have a table in SQL Azure storage as well to kind of control that. Then it pumps, here's a job, puts it in a queue. It's done. It can go to sleep, do whatever the hell it likes. Then we've got the other pieces which just read messages from the queue. So the thing that actually does calls the Twitter API and stores the results. pulls a message on the queue. Oh, go and search for bacon. Goes and searches for bacon, gets the results, stores it in the blob, puts a message in the queue. The aggregator pulls the message from the queue. Oh, go and aggregate bacon. Goes and reads the table store, does the aggregation, stores the results back, and the UI pulls directly from blob storage, potentially through the CDN, so we're going to get lightning quick response times here, all that data back. That's how we probably will build it with a few tweaks and whistles. Of course, when you create a new search, we want stuff to happen right now. So the new search is just going to create a search term, but then it's just going to go and call the API, go and store the results in blob storage, go and put it in table storage. So it's actually going to do everything in sequence as part of the web piece of this and store the results so that when you type in a search, you get an instant response. It's not instant. It's going to take 20, 30 seconds to pull that off, right? But you get some sort of instant feedback. And then from then on, the work will just carry on every 30 minutes or so. Decoupled, using queues, scale everything, scale the partitions, scale the queues, scale the instances. We're using the CDN as well. And that is the ultimate scale-out child for images, blobs, any kind of content. So I'm going to take a little detour a little bit, and then because all that kind of made me think about compute. And I had a bunch of concepts I wanted to talk about, and I didn't quite have I didn't want one-word slide, so I had two-word slides, I guess, on this. So here's some cloudy tips. I'm building my app. It's compute. I'm using ASP.NET, C#, VB, whatever it is. I'm 64-bit. If I'm using third-party DLLs, they should be 64-bit as well. Otherwise, you're going to run into some hickey issues. Really important that, especially when you're building on a 32-bit machine, don't be forcing the code to be generated to be 32-bit. Leave it at any CPU. That usually works great. Second thing, everything you want to run in the cloud, ship it to the cloud. Here's the thing. Works great on my cloud, on my box. Works great on my machine. I had a reference to this DLL. I run it in the dev fabric. It works great. I go and deploy it to the cloud. I come back, and it's sitting in the cloud doing initialize, busy, initialize, busy, initialize, busy. Anybody seen that? You haven't deployed to the cloud then if you haven't seen that. Typically, there's a few reasons why that happens, but the biggest one is we've added a reference to a DLL. We haven't told it to copy local. If we don't make an assumption that DLL is in the cloud, even if it's a Microsoft DLL, don't make the assumption that we've got it in there. The general rule of thumb is if it's in the GAC, it should be there, but if it's anywhere else, it probably isn't. It may well be, but there's no harm in saying copy local and just having your thing copied up there. So check all your dependency, all your references are copy local. That's going to save you a ton of pain. Ship everything to the cloud as well. What if I'm not building a .NET application? What if I've got a PHP application? I want to run that. We run a bunch of PHP applications either on Apache or in FastCGI running on IIS. We run Tomcat. We run, Getty is another Java server. Deploying these kind of apps is exactly the same as a .NET app. You need two files. One is your configuration. One is your output from your project. Only in this case, your output from your project is going to either be PHP and your PHP app. Remember, don't assume it's in the cloud. You've got to ship it there. So if you want to run a FastCGI PHP app in the cloud running on IIS, your PHP folder has to be part of that package. So your package is going to have PHP in. It's going to have all your PHP DLLs in, your PHP.ne in, everything, as well as your PHP app, all together. If you want to deploy to Apache, guess what? You're going to have a folder with your Apache install in. You're going to have a folder with your root that you want Apache to run. You're going to package all that up and deploy that to the cloud. If you're running Tomcat, the model is the same. Everything gets packaged up and deployed to the cloud. All the things we talked about, storage, accessing SQL, all that kind of thing, is all doable from Java because, hey, it's just SQL Server, right? So you just need a SQL Server driver. from PHP, hey, it's SQL Server, so you just need a SQL Server driver, right? Table storage has implementations, I think, for Ruby, for PHP, and so on. Great, you just need to go and find those SDKs and get them down. Anybody not using Microsoft stuff in the room, want to just put your hand up, because so we can get you later. No, that's Java. Yep, Java, yeah. iPhone? Python as well. Hey, Python. So yeah, we can run all those things, but you've got to ship everything up. Just in the same way as for .NET, you've got to ship everything up there. Okay? I keep getting people coming to my office and go, Dave, what does stateless mean? It says I need to have a stateless service. All that means is state isn't inside your compute, it's somewhere else. It's no different from having a web form and sharing state there. You have to put the state somewhere else. It could be in blob storage, a table storage, it could be in SQL Azure. In ASP.NET, we have membership providers and all that kind of funky stuff. Hey, guess what? They will work fine in SQL Azure, except the session state doesn't. If you need session state to work in SQL Azure, maybe you don't. Maybe you need session state to work in table storage. That would be the way to approach it. But there's providers written already that you can download and plug in, and so that your membership will just work. Your profile will just work in exactly the same way. You don't have to think about it. It's just a config change. Okay? Setup is a little bit different, obviously. You run a different command line. You might have to run a couple of scripts to get the tables created and things like that. But it's relatively painless. But state really means if I've got state in my compute, as soon as that compute gets turned off, it's gone. Or if I'm in a web environment and I've got 10 instances running, the load balancer, just think it round robins, right? You're never going to hit the same connection twice. You might well do. There might be some stickiness at some point, but you just got to ignore it right now, right? You've got to code around that. So some things to think about. Remember, you don't get an SLA unless you've got two instances running. So you'll see all my demos have one instance running because I really don't care whether they run or not. I don't need them running 24/7. But you probably might, so you need two instances running to get an SLA. Why? Because the only way we can guarantee you running is if we deploy you across different fault boundaries. Craigie, what does that mean, Dave? Fault boundaries easy. We got a rack of stuff here, on different power, on different networking, probably somewhere else. We've got another rack. It might not be a rack, but it might some other part of the data center that's fed differently for power and things like that. If you deploy two instances, you'll be on two different fault boundaries. That goes down. At the worst case of power failure or something like that, you've still got an instance running. Our fabric goes, oh, Craigie, you were down to one instance. We'd go and spin you up somewhere else. Okay? All before you notice, hopefully. A little bit about rich client apps. People are, hey, can I use Silverlight with Windows Azure? Yes, absolutely can. It's just IIS. You're just serving out a file. You can serve a file out from blob storage. But Dave, you need the client access policy. We added a dollar root container, which allows you to put your client access policy in there. Now Silverlight just works great being served out of blob storage. Take it one step further, put it in the CDN. Kind of cool. CDN, by the way, is real simple. It's blob storage. Tick the box to say you want it in the CDN. You've got to fill out a couple of dialog boxes, but that's it. And then you can access your blob storage through one of the about 18 endpoints around the globe. And your content will be served from whichever is the nearest one. Now, you all sat through Brad making your ears bleed with tables. And Dave Robinson telling you SQL Azure is just SQL with a little bit more. How do I choose one between the other? I'm building an app. SQL Azure seems to be the easiest. I know how to use SQL. But then I've got this 1 gig and 10 gig and 50 gig thing. What if I need 60 gig? They tell me I have to partition. That sounds really hard in SQL. Table storage sounds like I don't get any indexes. I've just got a partition key and a row key. And if I want to search by last name, I do a table scan of a billion rows. How does that work? How do I do this? If I do use table storage because I need the scale, how do I do things like what's the top 10 users what's the top 10 items that are being viewed? So I thought it'd be cool to show a different app that did this. So we have an app called BidNow. It's a quite an old app. It's been around for about a year. We've just revved it. I have the latest build running. And we put this out on CodeGallery, assuming the internet connection works. Sometime later today or early in the morning, there'll be an update out there. But this is the homepage, and the homepage brings back some stuff. And it brings back the categories. So what categories of item can I... BidNow is a bit like an online auction site. So you can imagine we might get lots of users if this was real. We also have bids ending soon. Now, I bet lots of you are picturing in your head, select bid, comma, blah, from bids where end time is, you know, you can formulate that kind of query. Yeah. What about the most viewed items? Perhaps every time I view something, I just increment a counter in that table. And then I can just go, hey, select top five from bids where I'd added that. And then we've got the hot list. The hottest is the ones with the most bids on. Now, this gets complicated because I'm thinking in SQL. I've probably got my item table. I've probably got a bids table. I've probably got a join between them. Now I'm going to have a select with a join and a count and a group by. Yeah, you can figure that out. You've kind of got some image in your head, right? We don't use SQL Azure. There isn't any SQL Azure in BidNow. The SQL Azure team hate me because I built this and I didn't put SQL Azure in it. But hey, this is what we've got. Every one of those is a table, a separate table. And every time we do something, we go and update all of the tables. Now, I want you to step back a bit and think back to SQL Azure or SQL. And I've got a table and I've got another table and I've got some joins and stuff like that. And I probably write a query that groups by. Let's say we pick the hottest item. So we want to go and query the bids, do a group by, find out which is, you know, do a count group by, whatever like that. Anyway, how do you make that go fast? You create an index on it, right? Create an index on that view, and maybe that improves the performance of that. So what SQL then does is it essentially maintains a separate table with those columns in that right order with that thing. That's essentially what an index view is doing, right? But it maintains that for you. So when you insert a row and update a row, it also goes and updates all of the indexes, right? And that's why you're told, hey, don't have a load of indexes on if you want to do lots of things in your database because it slows it down. But then if you want faster queries, you create a lot of indexes because that speeds it up, because essentially what SQL's doing is creating different shapes of your data that it can very quickly return back. Doing counts is another great thing SQL's great at, because when you do an insert to a table, it also maintains externally of the table in its metadata how many rows it has. So when you do a count star, it doesn't count all the rows, it just goes and reads that piece of metadata and goes, ha ha, look how fast I am. In the cloud, you don't have any of that funky stuff. In Windows Azure Tables, you don't have any indexes. You don't have any index views. The count doesn't work. You want to count how many rows you've got in, you better have been keeping count as you were inserting. So you've got to kind of do a lot of the work that SQL is doing for you. So there's a coding cost to pay for this. Now, I'm going to flip across to here. I'm just going to prove that stuff does run in the cloud. That's the thing we deployed earlier. It all says ready on there. You can actually hit it, and this doesn't have the real UI on. This has a back end. This has an optimized back end, but it has a UI that is I don't know, Silverlight. Am I allowed to show you Silverlight 5? I don't know. This is running Silverlight 5 on there. If it actually loads, you should laugh because it's actually just a text box and a grid. There's no Silverlight or anything like that. I'm renowned for my lack of design skills when it comes to UIs, but we'll let that load a little bit. So I wanted to show you just some of the BidNow code. In fact, the BidNow app kind of runs on here. This is live. I can do a refresh and things are going to change because since I loaded this page up before my talk, some of those items most viewed should have changed. So 2 hours, 29 minutes for Sour and Practice. We should get a refresh. Please, cloud. Please, cloud. I shouldn't say please, cloud. I should say please, internet connection. and this must be the first time I've done this demo, and so now it's down to 40 minutes. This is the first time I've done this demo, and SharePoint books haven't been on the top. I know why. It's completely random how we load the data in, so it's kind of a puzzle. But normally there's some SharePoint thing on the top there. So the plot, quite simply, is if I want to kind of go and say, well, this is most viewed. So if I go into treadmill, it's running a little slow, so we might have to give it a little bit of a, I don't know why it's running slow. But if you go into that treadmill, it's got a couple of bids on. $874 treadmill. It's got to be quite a treadmill. So we viewed it. I'm happy with view. It hasn't loaded the whole page, but we're going to go back to the home page because what we might see is that treadmill is now at the top, right? Now that you can navigate that URL on your laptop right now and kind of view things and change the order of them and whatever like that. Now what's happening is when you view on an item, we do some hocus pocus trickery. First of all, I'm going to show you one of the cloud tools that you can use. This isn't one of our tools. It's Cloud Storage Studio. You can get a 30-day trial. It's darn good little tool. And it allows you to view tables and all that kind of thing. I'm just going to go in here and look at the most viewed items table. And just hit refresh because I think that's off this morning. So what it's doing is basically running a query against my table, bringing all the rows back in. See, we've got a partition key, which looks kind of bizarre. And we've got a row key. Now, the only indexes you've really got in Windows Azure table storage is on partition key and row key, so you can use that. So what each of those are a short version of an item. And if we scroll along, it's got the photo URL, and look, it's got the treadmill. And the treadmill is the very top. Because what happens is when you view that treadmill, we run some code that changes the partition key. And basically we have a reverse number, and essentially what we do is we delete the treadmill row, and we create a new one with a different partition key. And just because of the way Windows Azure Table Storage works, we end up being in the right order to do a top. And we just read the first 10 rows. And that's how we do it. When a bid ends, we have a process that goes through all of these little lookup tables and deletes it. So we essentially build all of that maintenance for reviews and things on top of this. This, by the way, is incredibly scalable. We can put billions and billions of rows through this, and it will keep up. Question there. That's a great comment from the room. Are we back to the magnetic drum days? It seems like we're, you know, all you need to know is an old person. You're right. It's a lot of those techniques. You know, if you go back 20 years, what we could do in a relational database compared to what you can do now is very different. And almost for this scalable storage in, you know, in this NoSQL kind of realm, you're back at square one where you've got to build a lot of the infrastructure yourself. I think what will happen is over the next few years, we'll get better at building stuff on top of that. So then you'll just be kind of like, I'm going to create a table and I ain't going to worry a lot about this because I might have secondary indexes. I might have some things in SQL Azure that will auto-partition for me and so on and so forth. But right now today, I make the joke, you just need to find an old person who knows all this stuff, pick the brain and then just write a deck and you'll look real cool. All right. just beyond that, on the thing. So essentially what we've done is we've built our own view, our own index view, and we're storing this in table storage. If we take a look at some of the code that goes on in this, this is my auction service. Basically, the auction details page makes a call into increase auction view items view. So when I view the page, something goes, go and do this. It calls a service. Now, can anybody guess what this service does? Hey, puts a message in the queue. And have I just lost? There we are. Queue, add message into a queue. Because we don't want to deal with it right now. We're going to deal with it. Yeah. And think about it. If anybody really knew how many times an item was viewed, we'd be screwed, right? But if it happens a few seconds later, probably no big deal, right? So we pop a message in the queue, and then we basically have a worker role. Now here, what I decided to do was for the purposes of a demo, I have one worker role on this. But I have all the things it might want to do implemented as essentially a handler. And I just create a list of handlers and then go and start them each in threads. And you can all go, hey, Dave, that's really lousy thread programming code. You shouldn't do that, blah, 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 blah. Why am I doing this? I ain't ever going to run this in production. I'm doing this to test because then I'm only paying 12 cents per hour for my compute instead of a whole bunch of sensors per hour for lots of computes on that. Okay? So work with me on that. So then we've got a view item handler, and basically the view item handler, guess what it does? It pulls the message from the queue. And there's two commands we can give to it. One is an add and one is a remove. And if we give it an add command, it basically goes and reads the message, reads the item in from that table we've just seen, goes and figures out the new partition key by doing some clever inverted counting and ordering, courtesy of Marx, because that's how he does a lot of things in his blog and stuff like that. Same principle. And we go and write the rule back down again. Piece of cake. That's it. So a couple of things there. One is we're using that worker role. We're really abusing threads here, but we're getting it to do lots of things. It's great when you just want to run some tests in the cloud or you're doing a demo or something like that. In a production, we'd split, and each instance would probably have a separate handler because some handlers resize images. Some of them do counting things like this. Some of them process auction bids. Now, you kind of want a lot of them, but maybe resizing an image to create thumbnails isn't that important. So, again, you can mix and match on there. Another cool tool we've got around here is we've got an MMC console, which is out now, but has storage in, and we've just added a bunch of stuff which we're testing for managing services as well. So as well as the PowerShell commandlets, this builds on top of that and lets you do deployments, lets you view blob containers, the queues. In fact, it's going to try and refresh the list of queues here. And this is the queues in the bid now, so it hopefully it'll come back with a big list of the different work queues in there. And then maybe it won't. Maybe it'll just take its time doing that. So another great tool to kind of play with. And again, you can all the APIs there, all the codes there, you can kind of go and write your own on that. So the other thing, go back to this. So that's kind of, we use tables there, but quite honestly, there's a kind of a thing. Back to the archivist, we use blob storage in some cases, SQL Azure in other cases. I think today when you're building apps for on-premises, you get told, hey, use SQL Server to store all your stuff. Yes. So then you go into your 300 gigabyte SQL Server database, and what have you got? You've got like an 8K raw with like 2.5 megs worth of image data stored as binary stuff, right? We find a lot of people who barf at the 10 gig limit or the 50 gig limit because they have 300 gigs worth of data. How am I going to do that? Have a lot of image data, a lot of binary data in there. Why don't you pull that out and store it in blob storage and just save a link to the blob? Kind of works. Sometimes even pulling data out of table storage and putting it into SQL and doing some work on it while you've got indexes and stuff and then taking it out and storing the results back in is possible. So don't limit yourself by, hey, I've got to use SQL Server. It's 10 bucks a month for a 1 gig database. It doesn't matter how much or how little you use it. It's 10 gig. It's 10 bucks a month. So if you can use it in weird and wonderful temporary kind of ways, then you should go ahead and do that. Some data just makes sense in table storage. And remember, table storage is got the dumbest name in the world, right? Table. Table just implies foreign keys, primary keys, relationships, group by, that kind of thing. Tables are just, the only two things we care about are primary key, partition key. It's got the same acronym, right? Partition key and row key. We don't care about anything else. In fact, everything can be different. So on bid now, I can go on my profile, and what I see on my profile is all the information about me, so email address, telephone number, that kind of thing. Then I see a list of all the items I've ever bidded on, I see all of the items I've ever sold, and I make one query to get all of that data back. And here's why. Row number one, partition key, my user ID. Row key, I think we called it user data or something. First column or first property in there is first name, then last name, then email, then telephone number. That's the first row. The second row in there, primary key, my username, row key, probably bid one. The item number of the bid, the URL to the bid, to the image of the item that I bought, the name of the image, the name of the item I bought, and so on. Row two may be the next one in that list. It might be bid two, or it might be sold one. But essentially what I end up with is a table where all of my rows in my partition are all different shapes. And then what I can do is I know it's naughty, select star from table, whatever I've called it, where where partition key equals David's user ID. And I get back my info, all the things I've sold, all the things I've bought, yada, 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 with one call. You can do that in SQL, yeah? And the SQL command would look like select star from users where username equals David's user ID in a join table foo, far, and whatever. You'd join all of those tables together. Here we just kind of denormalize and mash everything together. So, key. I knew I'd talk around to that. I knew I'd talk that the wrong way, even as I started. Key, denormalize. If you want to go into Windows Azure tables, just think, how denormalized could I go? And after you get a few apps under your belt kind of doing it, you'll be surprised at where you're kind of living in that space. Partition, why might you partition? One is performance. Remember, you've got lots of little things. You don't have your 144,000 HP box, right, with 48 cores, although that would be quite nice to run home server, right? But you've got lots of these little partitions running on little cheap machines. Don't think I've got a 32-way box running my database. Think I've got 32 one-way boxes running my database. That's how you've got to think. Size is an issue. Whether it's in table storage, keep your what's in a single partition down, or SQL Azure, keep what's in a database down. Cost. Windows Azure table storage, 15 cents a gig. SQL Azure, $10 a gig. There's trade-offs, how much work you've got to do, how you use them, blah, 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 features you get. Remember, we charge you for accessing Windows Azure table storage as well, which sometimes can be higher than the cost of actually storing stuff. Throttling, you might want to partition because you're going to get throttled. Guaranteed. SQL Azure is running in a shared environment. David talked about this, either David. When you're querying data and things, if you hammer the hell out of it, you will get throttled. Your connection will get cut. So you've got to think, how do I partition? How do I work around that kind of issue as well? What's really appropriate is, and I don't normally show errors, but as I looked at the word appearing on the screen, I also saw there was a thing on there as well, which we'll just ignore and go. Failure. This is really important. Because it's real simple. We have SLAs that read 99 something of the time will keep you running. But I have the hidden SLA. 100% of the time guaranteed your app will fail in our data center. Guaranteed. Absolutely 100%. And here's why. We service pack you. If nothing else goes wrong, at some point, we have to put a security patch on. So at some point, we have to take your instance down. Now, you do have some code that you can respond to these events with. So here's the plot. Patch is coming out. The fabric's rolling out around the data center, gets to your instance. We're going to probably put you somewhere else because we'll just move you somewhere else, right? Doesn't matter. But we're going to say, hey, you know, you're stopping. And we'll give you a little bit of time to kind of go, I need to finish and stop doing new things. Stop reading new things from the queue, yeah? But essentially, I've got to stop because I've been spun up somewhere else. That's the way to think of it. So great, now I've got this API I can respond to, this event I can respond to. Fantastic. However, other times, stuff will fail. Now, if you look at the mean time between failure of a hard disk, a typical hard disk, and then go multiply it by all of the disks we've got in our data center, there's probably a disk failing every few minutes, right? Just mathematically. Doesn't really mean it's failing every few minutes. You know, you get the idea. So at some point, your machine will also fail because of a hardware issue. Don't get me wrong, the software just runs fine, right? I was expecting more laughter, and it did come. So at some point, you're going to fail. You have to handle this. Remember, Brad and everybody talked about, hey, you read the message from the queue, you're doing some work, and then something happens, the message goes back on the queue. They never really talked about what might happen. And it's really irrelevant. Your software failed. It could be your failure. It doesn't matter. We'll spin you up against somewhere else, so potentially you could end up reading the same message on the queue. So let's look at this. I pull down some tweets, and I go and store them in a blob, and then I get deleted. Whatever happens, the hardware fails, wherever like that. Because I didn't delete the message from the queue, the message pops back in the queue again, and another worker picks that message up, goes and runs the query, pulls it back down, and stores the blob. And hopefully we've written some code to go, hey, that's funny. Looks like I've already done this. And then I can choose not to save that, or maybe I just overwrite what's already there. And then I'll put a message in the queue. So one of the design principles we're trying to put together for this app is, and I wrote it out because I think it's quite important. It doesn't matter how many times you do the same task. If it fails at the start, the end, or the middle, or repeats 300 times, the answer is always the same. In my bank account, whoever ends up building the system for my bank, I would like you to ignore this rule under some circumstances, particularly the one where I get money putting into my account. So some systems, like the Twitter Archivist, probably we're going to find it real easy to kind of build this kind of thing, okay? If I'm building some banking application, I'm probably going to want something that supports transactions. And maybe, just maybe, I'm using SQL Azure for those kind of things. That gives me the transaction support. Just maybe. Just thinking outside of the box there. But do keep that in mind. Guaranteed 100% failure. Design for it. I have 11 minutes to go through this. Crikey Moses. I could talk for days on this. If your service, and I had lots of different words in here, but eventually sucks kind of summed it all up. Could you figure it out? Your stuff's running in the cloud. You can't remote desktop to it. You can't walk into the data center and plug something in. What do you do? Well, first of all, you do have the developer fabric debugging. Marx, did you stop at a breakpoint? You can set breakpoints. You can hit F5. It'll run, and it will stop at a breakpoint. I'm going to show you this in a moment. I'm going to roll a couple of things together in the same demo just to get through this. So that's great. You're on a single box, but you can run multiple instances. All of your storage is on the same box, so you're probably using named pipes or something like that. You're certainly not going across a HTTP thing across to another part of the data center to get at your blobs. Your two instances are running in the same process, for heaven's sake, so they're not on separate fault boundaries at different sides of the data center. So even the performance locally can be a little bit different from the cloud. In fact, if you've got one of those big, you know, dev boxes with your four cores and your 16 gig of RAM and you're running your five instance app, it's probably going to run faster than it does in the cloud, right? Because you've got no network between anything. You've got your machine just doing your five instances with your one user on, right? Great. So yes, you can debug and attach a debugger and get through all of that, but then you've got to go to the cloud. How do you know what's going on in the cloud? Well, we do actually have a solution. Ooh. We have a diagnostics and monitoring framework in the cloud. We have a little process that starts up, and its job is quite simple. It takes the logs, the perf counters, the traces, whatever you've told it to collect, and it reads them out of the instance, and it goes and stores them into blob and table storage for you. And you can schedule to do this every few minutes, every few hours, however you like. I'm thinking for perf counters, you probably want to be going to collect them every, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes or something like that. Maybe crash dump logs, you're only going to collect on demand, so you can do that as well. And again, we've provided an API for you, but no tools. So we have some PowerShell commandlets. Again, I'm not going to show you those, but those same PowerShell commandlets can help you set that up. We also have a few samples that are coming to help make it easier. And I'm going to show you one of them right now. So I'm going to flip to the demo machine. And I was hoping I would have cleared all of that before we got there, but never mind. So I have quite a few things open, but this is my monitoring head, right? My job's great because I get to write the cool bit of code that's figuring something out, and then I go and give it to somebody else who then probably throws it out, quite honestly, and builds what I really wanted them to build. And then they give it back to me, and then I pretend it's mine. So this has one method, and what I wanted to do was, if you want to turn all the monitoring on and not worry about it, I just wanted one line of code that you had to add in a DLL, because we can't get into the DLL thing. So I created this setup monitoring thing, and I wrote enough code that the real dev behind it knows what to do. At least I think I did. So basically, and you can write this code, and it's real simple. What I do is I go and read an XML file. An XML file basically says, hey, I want these perf counters, I want these logs. Okay? Very straightforward. And all this does is it reads the XML file in, creates a diagnostics monitor, and goes and enables crash dumps, sets the right code. Like, it does all the things for you. But basically, you've got to write some code that tells your compute, go and collect this perf counter. Go and collect this log. How often to do it? How much space to reserve for these things so that you don't end up having, you know, 200 gigs worth of log files drifting around and things like that. And then I start the diagnostics monitor, and that's it. This is my note to the guy who really does all the dev work. Like, hey, every 10 minutes it should check to see if that XML file's changed, and if it has, it should change the counters and things that's being collected. Okay. So then you can just add this piece of code to your worker role. And I've got a worker role here. And basically, if we go and find the on start, I basically go and call mhead1 monitor boot setup monitoring. And the final version, if it's looking for an XML file in blob storage, if it doesn't find it there, it's just going to create one with some defaults in. So you don't even have to think about that kind of thing. It's pretty cool. So that's great. So now I've set that kind of stuff up. I then get all of this data in blob storage and table storage and actually go and query that using something like the cloud tool or some of the other monitoring tools that take the perf data and graph it for you. And in our MMC that crashed a little moment ago, you can actually export the data to Excel and do graphs and pivot charts and things and really analyze how your service is behaving and things like that. So that's kind of cool. So we can get at all that data, but it's not in real time. So it's kind of after the horse has bolted, I've got some data, how useful is that? Well, turns out it can be useful. If you're in a controlled environment, you can get the logs and work through things. It also can be very kind of like, I really need to know what's going on right now. So we have a solution for that as well. In the AppFabric SDK that you can download in the samples folder, there is quite a neat little trick with the service bus. Remember the service bus, you basically make connections to it and then you can send stuff down. Earlier on, you were telling Marx's desktop to change. What if we built a trace listener that puts its messages out on the service bus? Then you could write an app that consumed that and displayed it in the console window. Hey, that's a really good idea. Why didn't we do that? We did. It's in the samples in the SDK. And it's very easy to implement. So let's take a quick look at this. So in my worker role, I have a couple of trace lines in here. Job schedule entry point. I've got a trace line here. Not a lot of tracing, right? Why not? The other thing I've got is in config, I have actually added a trace listener. Now, all of this, this is kind of like, wow, Dev, how do you work out all that kind of like code and things? This is the app that you get with the AppFabric SDK. It has everything in. It has the console, the listener, and a little test app. So you can very quickly get this set up and then put it into your app. It gives you the XML that you need to add in your app config and things like that. So once I've set that up, essentially what it's doing is it's saying, hey, add a listener on the tracing of the type service bus cloud trace listener. That is here, and I'm not going to walk through that code, but essentially it takes the trace message and puts it on the service bus. I actually have it running here. Ding! It's a console app, my favorite kind of app. And if I go and run the Archivist locally, what we should see is those trace messages will start to appear. Now, I'm running locally. I've got 5 instances. It's going to take a couple of minutes to spin up, and then we should start seeing some things. So I'm going to flip back, just in the interest of time, flip back to the deck. As soon as I see some messages coming up, I'll do a quick flick back on there. But essentially, we can get that real-time feed out of our instances through the service bus and see what's going on, particularly if we're finding that we're crashing before we get a chance to collect those logs. Yep. If the role recycles before the job to copy stuff out happens, then the only way of doing it is with this service bus. So that's kind of neat. Now... This is really interesting, because sometimes your app's running and stuff's not working. I'm just going to flip it onto here because it happened quicker than I thought. There's my traces starting to come out. Every 30 seconds, I'll get a new kind of thing on there. But sometimes when your app's running and you go, oh, Craigie Moses, something's going wrong. Let's turn on all these logs and perf counters and have that collecting every minute and blah, 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 and things like that. What you're doing is you're changing the behavior of the app, and sometimes the bug can go away. Or out there, how it manifests itself. And we've hit this a few times where we've turned on all the tracing and everything like that, and things have happened in the app as a side effect of that, which has changed the behavior of the bug, which has made it difficult to troubleshoot. And I just wanted to kind of pull it out. And of course, this has to be right because the source is Wikipedia, which is the fountain of all knowledge. So do kind of, it's a new word. Idempotent was last year's new word, wasn't it? Capacity planning. We had a little conversation earlier about using queue lengths and figuring out how, you know, increasing instances just based on the amount of workload I got coming through. But if I can turn all these perf counters on and collect them, then I could start to draw graphs and analyze patterns, and then going back to those other usage scenarios where I've got predictable bursting and things, I could analyze that and then figure out, oh, well, on a Tuesday, I need 2 instances. On a Wednesday, I need 5 instances, and so on. One example is great. Photo sharing sites. Sunday apparently needs lots of service because everybody's uploading photographs on the weekend, right? Everybody must be working on Wednesdays because don't need that many servers lying around doing this. So great use for the cloud. How do you spot those patterns? By collecting that log data. We've got to help the IT pro with this, because they're going to be the ones who's going to change the knobs, turn them up and turn them down. But we've got to give them the data to do that. Thus, my one line of code can turn that on for them, and we can just let them go and use their tools to tweak and whatever like that. So do keep in mind that auto, that capacity planning, and it enables you to go and build some auto scaling code to do that. And I think there's a couple of samples already out on CodePlex that do that. So, with mere seconds to spare, that is the end of my talk. We have a break, I believe. I'm going to answer a few questions, but we have a break now, is that right?
Yeah.
So, if you do need to break, then great. If not, I'll take some questions. But first of all, thank you very much. You've been a pleasure to talk to. So the question is, if I have an unhandled exception which causes my role to recycle, and then it spins up again, and the same exception occurs and it causes to recycle, how long does the fabric controller leave this running before it shuts it down? I've never seen it shut it down. It'll just keep it going. It'll keep it recycling. It'll just sit and recycle and recycle and recycle and recycle. forever. We don't pretend to understand your code. It might be perfectly acceptable behavior to recycle every 10 seconds. I don't know, but that's kind of what we do. Question here. So the question is, if I want to run 10 instances during the day and no instances during the night, do I have to script that or will it happen automatically? You have to make it happen automatically. So either through a script or writing some code that runs on a timer or something like that. But you have to build that piece that talks to the API to tell it to go up to 10 instances or to go down to zero instances. Oh, can't go to zero instances. You have to undeploy. But you get the idea. You're in control of that piece. We don't pretend or have anything that allows you to automate that. Yes, or living outside of your app. It could be living in another part of the cloud. And we're seeing a lot of tools leaning that way just because it's convenient. Yeah.
But if you're just going down to one instance or something, which is what a lot of people do, drop the one, so it's still there, then you could make that part of your worker role or whatever.
So if you don't do that, if you only deploy because you're cheap,
yeah,
and you're started in your case, what happens if you get like four or four? If you want to deploy, you get like a big hit.
Yes.
You'll get 404, you get a can't connect to the.
Yeah, you get contact, yeah.
You get a fail whale from Azure?
No, you get a browser giving you whatever error it gives you when it can't find a server. I mean, it's like no one answers. It's not that no one answers. It's
so the question is, if you have nothing deployed, what do you get a 404 error? No, because there's nothing to process and send a 404 error out. There's just nothing there, so you don't get a response. Not without using redirects somehow. But you need something running.
Yeah.
Yeah.